We have this week's portion. I can't say any particular portion is more exciting than others, but in terms of sensationalism and dynamics and controversy, perhaps this is maybe described as the most controversial portion. In the portion, we have a number of topics. It's Parshas Toldos, and it begins on page 124, 125 of the Yod Scroll Chumash. And so in the portion, we have a lot of topics. The first part, it starts off discussing the pregnancy of Rivka. The Rivka, the wife of Yitzchak, they didn't have children for a number of years. And it was only after about 10 years of praying, of davening fervently to Hashem, that they had children. So Yitzchak and Rivka have children, and the famous story is that Rivka became pregnant with twins. She had a very, very difficult pregnancy. Medrash says that as she would walk by a place of holiness, a base medrash, a shul, a synagogue, some kind of place of holiness, so then she would feel a tugging in one direction. And then when she would walk by a place of avodah zarah, of idolatry, a place of ill repute, she would feel a tugging in a different direction. And these were the first signs of the two personalities that were developing inside of her, that of Yaakov, Jacob, and Esau. Now, in previous years, we have discussed a very fundamental question, an ethical, philosophical question, and that is the issue of nature versus nurture. Because what we see happening in the portion, as we go through the portion, we see these two very divergent personalities emerging, going in different directions completely in life. And yet, over here, based upon the first account of Rivka's pregnancy, there was even evidence of those two different proclivities emerging even in pregnancy as well. And it begs the question of nature versus nurture. And were they born, were they programmed to be this way? Were Yaakov and Esav, Jacob and Esau, quote-unquote, programmed to be the personalities that they were supposed to become later on, good and evil? So that's the fundamental philosophical question. And we've discussed that in previous years. The answer is simply no. The basic answer is no, they're not programmed. These are proclivities in a certain direction, which I'll get into later on, which can lead to either righteousness or wickedness. But nobody ever is programmed to be righteous or wicked. It's one of the most basic ideas of free will. That, it says in the Torah later on in Devarim, Bechata Bechayim, to choose life, that's free will. We have the freedom of choice to either do the right thing or to do the wrong thing in life. Yeah, even if a person is born with certain personality traits and certain physical appearances and proclivities, these are merely vessels. They are kalim, they're called vessels, they're utensils to use in the right direction, in the right way, and we have the freedom of choice how to use the gifts and the talents that have been given to us. Actually, one of the things which stands out is the fact that the Torah says that when Esau was born, he came out very red. He had like a red complexion. He was red, and the redness also in Hebrew is Edom. Edom is redness, and Edom, the root of the word Edom, is dam, which is blood, and it implies a certain passion, a certain hot-headedness. So there is got to be careful what I say now. There is a little bit of a discussion, you know, both from Jewish sources and also secular sources as well, is whether a person who's a redhead, you know, like the passion and the heat of a redhead, is that something which is there a connection between redheadedness and fieriness and passion and hotheadedness? So, but nonetheless, you know, this was Esav. There's actually it's interesting. There's another person in history, Jewish history, who also had red hair, fiery red hair, was David HaMelech, King David. And we see a very, very stark contrast between David HaMelech, King David, and Esav in this portion, because Esav does eventually become rotten, and ultimately the ancestor of anti-Semitism. But David HaMelech is obviously the great paragon of spirituality, and he wrote Psalms, Sefer Tehillim, which is just filled with such passion, passion of connection to God, of desire to connect to God. So that was an example of how a person takes their proclivities and channels them in the right direction. So I said more than I was supposed to say about this. We've discussed in previous years, nature versus nurture. But anyway, the portion goes on and then tells about their birth, their growing up, their development, and then the true personalities coming out as they get older and they go in divergent ways in terms of what they are drawn to vis-a-vis spirituality versus more physicality, materialism. And then the culmination of that development is when Esav ends up actually selling the birthright. The birthright, which we'll talk more about, the birthright of passing on the baton of the spiritual legacy of the Jewish people. He passes it over and says, you know, I don't need this anyway. I'm going to die anyway. He says, I don't even believe in the world to come. I don't believe in spirituality. I don't believe any of that. And therefore, I'm willing to relinquish it and give it over to my brother Jacob. And Yaakov buys it from him. He buys it, and it's illustrated by the fact that he's willing to sell the birthright for a bowl of lentils. And he buys this bowl of lentils from his brother Yaakov as a statement of complete disparaging and degrading of the spiritual significance of being the firstborn, the birthright. And he gives it up. So that's what happens. Then the next part of the portion goes into almost like a repeat of the episode of Abraham and Sarah in a few portions ago. We have had a couple of times that Abraham and Sarah had to leave the land of Canaan for different reasons, for famines and for, we said, I think 1 or 2 weeks ago, we spoke about how they left the area where Lot was living to go to a more spiritual location. They went to Gerar in that situation, in that playtime. He went to Egypt when there was a famine. And now we have almost a repeat again of the same thing where Yitzchak and Rivka also leave Eretz Canaan to go to Gerar. And what's really intriguing is that the same thing that Avram said about Sarah, to say to them that you're my sister and not my wife, Yitzchak does the same thing as well. They spend some time in Gerar. And again, this is not the topic for this week. That's the next passage. And then the next passage in the Torah is the real sensational passage of the actual giving over the blessings of the birthright. Even though earlier on I mentioned that Esav had sold the birthright, that seemed to have been a little bit of a transaction, a deal between the two of them, between Esav and Yaakov. It doesn't look like Yitzchak knew anything about that. But Yitzchak now calls Esav in to his tent and gives him a job of going out to hunt game, and then bring back the game, make it into delicious food. And by Yitzchak eating this delicious food and that which he likes, it would inspire him to then pass on the bracha, the blessings to Esav, his firstborn. And he wants to give the firstborn right to Esav. And he sees him to be the appropriate one. And again, we'll get into that as well, why he thinks he's the appropriate recipient of the blessings, even though I just described before that Esav was going in a different direction. But he wants to give the blessings to Esav, and he goes off and he hunts, comes back. Actually, before he comes back, the sensational part of the story takes place where Rivka knows what's going on, and she now advises Yaakov to disguise himself as Esav and to go in with subterfuge and to deceive the father. Yitzchak was blind; he couldn't see. His sight was very, very impaired. He couldn't see who was in front of him. He could feel the hands and famous line. These are the hands, it's the hands of Esau, but it's the voice of Jacob. But he was deceived. He was deceived into giving the blessings to Yaakov. He thought he was Esau. And again, the real controversial part of this is deception. How could Yaakov do that? How could Rivka and Yaakov do it? Rivka, the matriarch, Yaakov to become the patriarch. How could they engage in such a radical, you know, dishonesty to deceive their father, Yitzchak. So again, we discussed that in previous years as well. But he gives the bracha. I mean, he thinks he's giving the bracha. He's giving this blessing to Esav. And in actuality, he's giving it to Yaakov. And Shishi, the sixth Aliyah, is a very dramatic description. It's the sixth Aliyah actually begins with the blessing itself, with the final the climax of the blessing being conferred to Yaakov. And that's verse 28, chapter 27, verse 28. It says that Hashem shall give you the dew of the heavens, the fat of the land, etc. And it goes on, a few more elements of the blessing. And it's so dramatic. Verse 30, it says, Vayihi kasha kil Yitzchok levorach es Yaakov. And it was when Yitzchok was finishing giving the blessing to Yaakov, mamish, literally in the same moment, Yotzi Yaakov me'es p'nei Yitzchok aviv. Yaakov was walking out of the tent like a revolving door. And as he's walking out, Esav walks in to receive the blessings. He comes in with the meat to get the blessings. And then what a reaction. What a reaction, can you imagine? He's brought also, he brings in the tasty foods. He brings it into his father. Here I am. I've got the food for you. Can I get the brachas? And then Yitzchak is just completely dumbfounded. He's just astonished. V'yechrad Yitzchak charada gedola. Has the most tremendous trepidation. Charada gedola is just terrified. And he said, who was the one who brought the meat to me before, the venison before? Who was the one who trapped the animal for me before and brought it to me and I gave him the bracha? So when Esav heard this, he also cried out, a tremendous cry, very bitter cry. He said to his father, please, can you give me a bracha though? I'm sorry, I missed one part. He said, I gave brachas to your brother, so I don't have any brachas to give now. I can't give the bracha anymore. And he says, he pleads for a bracha. And he's able, and he gives him a bracha, a different kind of bracha. So this is very dramatic and very challenging to understand the dynamics and the psychology and the motivations of everyone and what was going on. It's very, very challenging. So, and I say it's challenging. It's we can look in the Mephorshim, the commentaries, and there's a lot of commentaries, obviously, which go into all of these, all the different motivations and elements. And, we could spend weeks on this, but I want to avoid the controversy. I want to just zero in and focus specifically on the bracha itself, because that I found interesting. I've never really understood, appreciate the exact bracha, because the bracha which Yitzchak does give, let's just push aside the deceit and who should get it. He gives it to Yaakov. He's giving it to Yaakov. He's the one who's receiving it, even though he thinks it's Esav. What is the bracha which he gives to him? And in his mind, in Yitzchak's mind, again, he's passing on the baton of spiritual leadership to become the next Av, the next father of the Jewish people. And the bracha is, verse 28, it says, V'yitin l'cha Elokim mital l'shamayim mishmanei u'mishmanei ha'aretz. And may Hashem give to you of the dew of the heavens and the fat of the land. V'rov dogim v'tirosh, an abundance of grain and also wine as well. Now, three questions I'm going to ask about this verse. Three questions. First question is just a technical question, a grammatical question. So in Hebrew, the translation does it as well. The translation says, and may God give to you of the dew of the heavens and the fatness of the earth. What's the question? Basic grammar question. You don't start a sentence with and. And. So that's the first question. The Medrash asks this question. Rashi quotes the Medrash. And it says, the reason why it says, and he shall give to you, it's actually an allusion to like an ongoing process of giving, meaning to say that Hashem is going to give to you, or shall give to you, and will give to you, and will give to you, and will give to you. So it's an allusion to the continuity of the blessing. It's always going to last forever. The problem with that, of course, is that it's not really necessary to say. If you're getting a bracha from the creator of the universe, he says to you, listen, and he's going to give to you blank, blank, blank. I don't think you're going to expect it to be like just for a week or two. You're getting a bracha for life, for eternity. So is it really necessary to emphasize the fact that Hashem is continually going to be giving it to you? We don't say this with the other brachas which are given later on with Yaakov when he gives the brachas to his children and Moshe to his children. So that's the first question. The second question is, if really the whole concept which is being conveyed in the portion is the passing on of the spiritual legacy and mission of the Jewish people to the next generation, to the next patriarch. It's kind of, it doesn't really seem to touch upon that. I mean, it's like, you know, if you go to, if I would take you to see my Rosh Hashiva, for example, in Brooklyn, and, you know, you want to go to have an audience with a very, very holy person, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, right? All these famous people, leaders, and they come to give you a bracha. The kind of bracha you'd be expecting to get from such a person is a bracha of inspiration. Hashem should help you, and you should be inspired, and you should learn Torah. You should merit to learn Torah and to do mitzvahs and always be strong and always be connected and raise a family. You know, a bracha is a, you know, of course we all need physical blessings, no question. I mean, we need physical things too, but it's kind of missing the point. Why is he not giving a bracha of a spiritual blessing, a spiritual, you know, a spiritual experience to him? Like, he should have a spiritual success, spiritual greatness in his life to lead the Jewish people and to be the father that he's supposed to be. Why the focus on, you know, do with the heavens? Blessings from the heaven, physical blessings of the heavens, dew of the heavens, fatness of the land, grain and wine. Why that? And the third question is a little bit of a technical question again as well, is why does he repeat? Why is the word Elohim, Hashem, repeated in the verse? The verse right before that, if you read the whole verse, including the verse beforehand, Yitzchak is speaking to Yaakov and he's saying, he says, I see the fragrance. You have the fragrance of the field. You have such you have a smell and aroma of Gan Eden upon you. That's what he recognized. He recognizes a certain spiritual proclivity that he had upon him. And he says, see, the fragrance of my son is like the fragrance of a field, a spiritual aroma coming from it, which Hashem has blessed you with. And so therefore he should give to you blank, blank, blank. Hashem had already been mentioned in the verse beforehand. He just said his verse. He just said Hashem's name. So why does he repeat Hashem's name again in this verse over here? So these are the three questions. Again, the first question is, why does it begin with and? Second question, why is the blessing focused on material largesse? And number three, why is God's name repeated again if it was just said a few words before that? They're the three questions. So the second question is the third question is, why is God's name is there again? So the Medrash actually says, Medrash answers this question, says, the word Elohim, one of God's names, denotes power, control and power. So the Medrash says that it's really referring to the power that his descendants are going to need. And the Medrash cites the example of Shimshon, Samson and Goliath, and how Shimshon was needed to have tremendous, powerful strength. So it's an allusion to that. So Elohim is not really referring to God's name per se, but it's referring to so he's slipping in like another blessing that Yaakov's descendants, some of them are going to need tremendous power, tremendous physical power to vanquish their enemies. And that's going to happen in the future of the Jewish people. That's one interpretation. But the more Hasidic, Slonim Rebbe, and Shem Mishmuel and other Hasidic masters, they explain it like this. They say that Elohim, when we say Elohim, so we could use the word Elohim more like Elokus. Elokus means godliness. So godliness, what is godliness? He's saying to him, and it's actually, this answers the second question as to why this blessing looks like a physical material blessing, when in actuality, it's not a material blessing whatsoever. It's the exact opposite, because the key is in that word Elohim. I could read the verse this way. I'm going to read it one way and then read it a different way. One way I could read the verse is, like I've been reading it all along, may God grant you the dew of the heavens and the fatness of the land, abundant grain and wine. That's one way of reading the verse. If you read the verse with this little bit of a knach in the word Elohim, that Elohim is Elokus, godliness, divinity, then you'd read it this way. Vayitein lecha, may he give to you. And who's the he? It's the he of the previous verse. Hashem has already been mentioned. May Hashem, this is the other answer, this is the answer to the other question. Why the Hashem had already been mentioned. So may Hashem grant you Elohim, godliness, divinity, in the dew of the heavens, and in the fatness of the land, and in the abundant grain and wine. That's it's precisely a spiritual blessing. You should experience spirituality. You should experience elokus, spiritual power, spiritual energy, divinity in every ounce and every element of your physical experience of life. May Hashem grant you. So whereas on the surface it looks like it's a physical blessing, it's precisely the opposite. It's a spiritual blessing. That's exactly what Yitzchak is giving to Yaakov. He's giving a spiritual blessing to him. He's telling him, may Hashem grant you to be connected spiritually in every facet of your life, in every blessing you experience, of physical blessing, material blessing, and everything you use in your life. May you experience godliness. May you have the presence of Hashem in every single part of your life. That's the greatest blessing. Vayitin lucha Elokim. May Hashem grant you Elokim mital shemayim, a godliness from the dew of the heaven, a godliness in the fat of the land, and a godliness in all of the wine you drink and all of the grain you have and everything. Everything should be turned into a purely spiritual experience. Everything should be spiritual. This is the greatest blessing that a person could have. This is what he would has to give to Yaakov, to the next generation, the next leader of the Jewish people. So that answers, you know, why God's name is repeated. It's not really being repeated at all. It's actually just a reference to godliness, and it also answers why it's not a physical blessing, because indeed it's really a spiritual blessing. Because this is the essence of being a Jew. The essence of being a Jew is that everything contains godliness. There's not a single thing which doesn't have godliness. I want to read to you the words of the Shem Yishmuel. Shem Yishmuel is a very famous Hasidic leader. He was a Hasidic Rebbe. And I actually should really know the real name. Shem Yishmuel, this is actually the name is given to the book he wrote. But he writes the following. He actually quotes from an earlier Kabbalist, Rav Chaim Vital, from the 1400s. I have to read it. I couldn't find the translation. I'm going to read the Hebrew and translate. He says, Achoma dov v'gufa, which means physicality. The physicality of existence is mechasa lukus, covers over spiritual divinity. The physical world does create like a barrier and a shield to the divinity which lies inside. At Sheina Nirgush, to the point that it's hard to sense and it's hard to find and hard to connect to the spiritual power and energy which lies inside every physical object. V'chein kol inyonim gashmiim, and this is the case with all physical elements of the universe. Makshimim es adam, b'ashachias alakos shabo, who beseys upon him that the spark of godliness, the spark of spiritual energy, is concealed, it's hidden away. Aval yesh tzaddikim, but there are righteous people. There are certain people who come and go in throughout life. She'eneyem pesuchos, that their eyes are open, not their physical eyes, but their spiritual eyes. V'roim b'chol dover, and they see in every single thing as elokus. They see the godliness in everything. V'choshech achoma lo yachshech mehem, and the darkness of the materialism does not darken their eyes, liros es elokus, to be able to see the spiritual energy in everything. Let tzaddikim elu, and regarding these tzaddikim, these righteous people, eina meichel mugushum klau, even a morsel of food is not a physical thing. Adarab, mosif koach v'chias ba'ad vodas Hashem, they look at this morsel of food, they see the spiritual power inside of it, that it's going to increase energy and spirituality in their and energy and power in their avodas Hashem, in their service of Hashem. V'zeh hoya birkas Yitzchak, and this was indeed the blessing that Yitzchak was giving to Yaakov. She'itin l'cha l'kus, that God should grant you, the Hashem should grant you this connection, this sense of elokus, of godliness, in the tal of the Shemaim, in the dew of the heaven. Sh'liya l'kus kol kach behesta behelim, that this godliness should not be concealed, it shouldn't be hidden away from your eyes. You should have a life of connection to Hashem. And that was the bracha he was giving to him. Beautiful. Isn't it beautiful? So, you know, this is what it means, like, you know, and it's a powerful concept because it reminds us of something we've spoken about so many times. And that is that life Jewish life is not about separating ourselves from the physical, but it's all about turning the physical into the spiritual and finding the spirituality in everything. And even though he's just written now about tzaddikim who can see, actually feel and sense the spirituality in everything, everyone has an access to that. Everyone can do that in some way or other. And it's a matter of kavana. It's all a matter of how we look at things. It really is. It's a, you know, for example, there's actually a verse, I couldn't find this, it says somewhere, God counts in the same way the nations of the world count. God counts numbers in the same way that the nations of the world count. What does that mean? A very cryptic statement. So the Slonimer Rebbe, he explains that what it means is that we count by digits, by 1, 2, 3, also by zeros. So one of the phenomena of counting is if you take zeros and you put a bunch of zeros together, what you get? You get zero, you got nothing. But all you have to do is put one digit, one, in front of all those zeros, and it turns it into an extraordinarily large number. By just putting one stroke of a digit one in front, it turns zeros into tremendous value of big numbers. When Hashem counts in the same way, it's the same concept that in life, in the physical world, you know, when the world and when a life is disconnected from Hashem, then it's zero. Now, that's a radical statement to say, but in the grand scheme of things, through the lens of Torah, through the lens of truth, ultimately, a life devoid of spirituality, a life disconnected from Hashem, it's an insignificant life. A life has to be connected to Hashem to make it significant. So you could have a whole bunch of activities and they're all zero, but as long as one puts the one before the oneness of Hashem, the unity of Hashem before the activity, all of a sudden it turns something which could potentially be impure, zero, nothing, it turns it into a spiritual act. The most mundane of things, the most physical, just regular daily life. That's what every daily life can turn into spirituality. It really reminds us of the proper kavana, intent to have in everything which we do. If you saw someone, maybe this would be, I'm going to describe a scene right now, which is very disturbing, right? And unfortunately, you have seen this happen in Jewish history, a disturbing scene, a Sefer Torah being burned. It's a terrible, terrible scene to see. But if I would tell you that there's a circumstance when it's legitimate to burn a Sefer Torah, or to burn a pair of tefillin, or burn a mezuzah, you'd be like astonished. Like, what do you mean? It's legitimate to burn it. How can you say it's legitimate to burn a Sefer Torah? So it's really shocking, but makes a lot of sense. The Rambam says, Maimonides says, the laws of tefillin, chapter 1, law number 13, a Torah scroll, tefillin, or mezuzah, written by an apikurus, written by a bona fide heretic, someone who lives a life detached from Hashem, denies God, completely negates God's existence, but he decides to write a Sefer Torah. He's a good sofa. He decides to write a Sefer Torah or a mezuzah. That's how he makes a living. The Rambam says should be burned. Such a Sefer Torah should be burned. Right? Why? Because the impure intent which goes into the writing of that Sefer Torah invalidates it and makes it unholy. It's not a holy book. It has no holiness to it whatsoever. It's a mind-boggling idea. Just the intent, the thought which goes into something can either turn something into an object of profound spirituality and significance, or can turn it into something which is very mundane. All with the intent, just the kavana a person has, makes all the difference in the world. There's a story told. There was the Majitzer Rebbe. He lived, one of these dynasties of Hasidim. This particular one, he lived, the more recent Majitzer Rebbe was in the 1950s, I think the story took place. Someone came into his shul on Friday night. A couple of guys came into the shul, and one of them was a Baal Teshuva. He wasn't always from. And he had a beautiful voice. He was asked to lead the Kabbalah Shabbos davening. So he was singing L'cha Dodi, L'Chodid, a beautiful song, and he sang it to a very, very beautiful melody. It was very, very inspiring, and people were so moved by this melody. So afterwards, they were going over to the Rebbe to wish him good Shabbos, and the Rebbe calls him over, and he says, that was a beautiful melody you were singing, L'Chodid. It was so moving. He said, you know, where's it from? So the fellow was a little bit embarrassed, because what it was actually from a secular romantic song. It was like a love song that he, you know, was without the words, obviously. And he took the melody and he just converted it into a beautiful melody for L'Chodudé. Now the Rebbe said, it was a secular song. He didn't really go into the details exactly. But then the Rebbe said to him, he said, you know what? I smell something impure about that song. There's something which is impure. I don't like it. There's something which I smell not good about it. He says, don't use that song. Don't use that melody ever again. Now, he could smell it. Now, I looked into this a little bit. There's just for the record, halachically, are we allowed to take secular songs and turn them into Jewish ones? So halachically, many poskim, many authorities say it's okay, but some feel it's not so good depending upon what was the intent in writing the song. So if the composer of the song was thinking about impure thoughts in the composition of the melody, then certain spiritual people, like this Rebbe, they can pick up on it, and they feel it's not right to use such a melody. So I'm not saying, we're not discussing halacha right now. There are many, many nugunim. In fact, when I was reading this, I was thinking about one of my favorite nugunim, which I sing on Shabbos, is to the Shabbos song of Dror Yikra, and so I sing it like this. It goes like this, I've heard a lot of people sing it this way. Here's my attempt to sing right now. I'll just sing the melody. Da 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 da. La da 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 na 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 na. And you're all singing. I see all your heads popping back and forth. So that's, yeah, but you all think it's Scarborough Fair, right? How could I sing this now if I'm just saying all of this? So I heard actually that Simon and Garfunkel, that one of them composed it. The legend goes that he got that melody from his great-grandmother who sang it to that song on Shabbos. That's what the legend says. So that's my justification for singing it right now and singing it on Shabbos. Anyway, but it's, you know, but it really, it, you know, the concept of infusing a spiritual kavana, a proper thought, and what we're doing to make it into spiritual activity is the essence of it all. And this was the difference between Yaakov and Esav. Now, why Yitzchak couldn't sense this in Esav, and he felt that Esav was the proper recipient to carry on this concept. You know, on the one hand, it says about Esav that he was a man of the field. Maybe colloquially we'll say he's a man of the world. He had more of a connection to the world. And that's really what it's all about. It's all about elevating the world. And Yaakov was an Ish Olim. He was a man of tents. He sat and studied. He was more secluded. So he felt, and this we had discussed in previous, Rav Dessler expands upon this and says that someone like that didn't need these brachas because he was already in that zone. He was already in the zone of spiritualizing everything. He didn't need, he was so detached anyway from the physical world. So Esav, more the man of the world, involved with the world. So he's the one who needs this bracha. The mistake was, and it's hard for me to say that, but this is obviously there was some type of misunderstanding over here, because Rivka understood it better than Yitzchak. Yitzchak felt that Esav would be able to receive this kind of bracha and be the leader, be the Ab, be the father of the next father. Rivka saw differently. She saw that he'd already departed too much into that material world. There's a certain threshold where a person, you know, can take the physical and elevate the physical, but then there's a certain point at which a person gets a drop too involved in the material, and it becomes too difficult, and they get sucked into it, and it becomes their lifestyle now. They are now completely immersed in the physical. Rivka saw this in Esav. Yitzchak didn't see this, so that's why he wanted to give it to Esav. But this is that. But in retrospect, the way the Torah describes Yaakov and Esav, in retrospect, it actually describes Yaakov's interesting nuance in the verse, in the description of Yaakov and Esav at the beginning of their lives. It says that Yaakov was an ish tam and a yoshev olim. He was a man, a pure individual, yoshev olim, a man who sat in tents. Actually, I said it wrong. Ish tam yoshev olim. He was a man of a pure man, sitting in tents. Only uses the word ish one time, ish, which means man. In contrast, Esav is described as an ish tzayid and an ish sada. He was a man of trapping as well as a man of the field. And the trapping part of that, even though on the surface it looked like he did hunting, the Medrash says that he was able to trick his father, gave the impression of being holier than he really was, asking interesting questions in halacha when really didn't really have the intention to know what the halacha was. It was more like a matter of impressing his father. But the repetition of the word ish, he was a man of this, he was a man of that, points to and kind of supports the idea that he was rather than having a broad life, having a double life. He had a double standard. He conveyed himself, presented himself as being holy and spiritual, and he really wasn't. He was a split personality. He led a double life, not a broad life. And that's the important distinction. A broad life is one who brings their spirituality into their physical mundane activity. That's a broad existence. It doesn't require a separation off from the physical world, but it's bringing the spiritual into the physical. That's a broad existence, a broad life. But a double life is someone who does one thing in one domain and does another thing in a different domain. You know, when he's in spiritual places, he does spiritual stuff. When he's in physical places, he does physical stuff. He's living a double life. That was the difference between Yaakov and Esav. Double life versus broad life. Interesting story. I read this story. In the 1950s, there was a fellow who went to a lot of Hasidic rabbis I'm quoting today. There was another, I never heard of this one, called the Shotzer Rebbe. The Shotzer Rebbe. So in the 1950s, the Shotzer Rebbe was approached by this fellow who asked him, he said, do you think we'll ever put man on the moon? Right? Will man ever go on the moon? So the Shotzer Rebbe said, no, it's impossible. He said, because the verse says, a pasuk in Tehillim, the heavens belong to Hashem and the earth belongs to mankind. So we'll never put man on the moon. That was in the 1950s. So 1969, day after my birthday, July 20th. So man goes on the moon. Now at this point, the Shotzer Rebbe had already passed away. So this fellow who asked him this question couldn't go back to him and ask him. But later on, he was close to another rabbi, the Biala Rebbe, and he told him what happened in this conversation. And the Biala Rebbe says it's not a contradiction; it's still true. He says because when it says that, you know, that the earth belongs to man and the heavens belong to Hashem, he said, you think that man was put on the moon? Now, don't get nervous. Not that the Biala Rebbe thought it was a whole conspiracy and it was a Hollywood thing. He said he knows that physically that Neil Armstrong was on the moon. He said, but how did he go on the moon? Could he walk on the moon like you walk on the earth? Of course not. You've got to take the earth with you to be able to survive on the moon. You've got to have the whole thing on your head with the oxygen. You can't survive. So the heavens belong to Hashem. Man cannot live on the moon. He can walk on the moon temporarily as long as he takes with him the environment of the world, of the physical world. He can survive on the moon. So the heavens belong to Hashem. The earth belongs to man. And that's really a very good illustration of what we're supposed to do as well. You know, we go onto the moon all the time, every single day of our lives. We're going onto the moon. What is the moon? Shopping, going to the supermarket. We are going to, here, there, and everywhere. We're doing things. We're involved with our business. We're involved with our, finances, whatever physical things we're doing. We're all going to the moon every single day. As long as we take the gear of the earth, what's the earth? The gear of spirituality with us. We can survive in those places. We can thrive and turn those places into spiritual places. But we've got to take the proper gear with us to be able to turn it into spiritual experiences. There was a I don't know if he's still alive or not, and I tell this story now, but my son-in-law, who's a doctor, staying with us, so he's going to be graduating as a doctor soon. So I don't know if you can hear, he's not somewhere in the house maybe. But there's in Shari Tzedek Hospital in Israel, there was a Dr. Moshe Wallach. And this is a good example. Someone who's busy in the physical world, helping people. I mean, obviously doing great things, but it says that every single day, I'm sorry, read this over. It says, Dr. Moshe Wallach, Shari Tzedek Hospital, when Dr. Wallach would visit a patient who was about to go into surgery, he always would ask him his mother's name so that he could pray for him before his operation. Rav Huttner, who was my Rebbe's Rebbe, commenting about this, he says, when I told this story over to one of the Gedolim, one of the great rabbis of Yerushalayim, he commented, how much a person must be jealous of such a Jew as Dr. Wallach, who uses his professional career as a vessel to promote the honor of heaven. This is not a double life. This is a broad life. It's not a contradiction. A person can be an ishtam, can be a pure-hearted, holy Yoshev Olim, person who sits in tents, attached to Torah, studying Torah, doing mitzvahs, grounded in the base medrash, grounded in the study hall of Torah, the tents of Torah, no matter where he may find himself during considerable portions of his day, and still always be attached. He can be in the physical activities of his day, but still very much, very, very much connected. And that's what it's all about. That's what the bracha is. This is the bracha that he's giving to him. Yaakov was one. Even though Yaakov had these innate proclivities to begin with, but he still needed it. He still needed it because it's hard to maintain this all the time. You know, this is great. It's a great message. It's a great program. Hard to maintain it constantly. Always, a person always needs siyata d'shmaya, needs help for this because it's easy to get dragged in. It's easy to get dragged away and get distracted. So we need a boost. We need a bracha. We need that bracha. And that's why Yaakov also needs this bracha. But this also explains why the word and appears at the beginning of the verse. So we ask that question, why does it say, and may God give you this? And we said, the Medrash says that it's a bracha, that what he's saying is, he should keep giving it to you, keep giving it to you. And we ask the question, you know, why do we need that? Let Hashem just give it all in one bout at the beginning. You don't need to keep giving it. But now that we understand that this bracha is more about turning the physical into spiritual, and elevating the spiritual, and not getting dragged down and not getting distracted by the material, and to turn every act into a holy act, we see now this is like a constant infusion, because we have this counterforce of distraction, the counterforce of being pulled away, and I need this boost. So even when I drift away and I go into a slump and I disappear and I don't have that connection, I forget about God and I feel like I'm like just disconnected and I feel the sense of despair, don't worry about it. Hashem will keep giving it to you. Hashem will keep giving it to you. He'll keep pulling you up. Never forget, never despair, never give up hope on the inspiration that Hashem will give to you, that he'll always lift you up even if you feel distant from him. And that's the repetition of the bracha. V'yitin lecha, v'yitin lecha, v'yachzor, v'yitin lecha, v'yachzor. Keep giving it to you. Never give up. He'll pick you up. Don't, you know, you could be in that moment, in that zone of, ugh, you feel like, yeah, I feel empty inside. Don't worry about it. Just let it pass. Hashem, trust in Hashem. Hashem will lift you up again. You'll come back to it. You'll come back to that spiritual connection. So that's the, you know, that's the bracha which he's giving to him. I found a really interesting, there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. And the halacha says the following, is when you make a bracha hamotzi, when you make hamotzi on bread, motzi lechem in the oretz, so there's a halacha to put, you know, both your hands on the bread, making sure that all 10 fingers are on the bread as you're making the hamotzi. Interesting halacha. So that the Shulchan Aruch says, the reason for this is because the 10 fingers are symbolic of the 10 mitzvahs associated with bread found in the Torah. There are 10 mitzvahs which revolve around bread in the Torah. The 10 mitzvahs are, quickly, It's forbidden to plow in the production of bread and grain and wheat. It's forbidden to plow with animals of an ox and a donkey together. It's forbidden to plant diverse species together. The stalks that fall during harvesting must be left for the poor. A sheaf forgotten in the field must be left for the poor. A corner of the field must be left unharvested for the poor. It's forbidden to muzzle a working animal. A portion of grain must be separated and given to the Kohen. A tenth of the remaining harvest must be given to the Levite. A tenth must be given to an eaten in Jerusalem, and eaten by the owner in Jerusalem. And a piece of dough should be put aside as challah. See, these are the 10 mitzvahs which are in the Torah relating to bread. So you put your 10 fingers on, reminded of the 10 mitzvahs. That's one reason. And then it goes on, the Shulchan Aruch goes on, and says, for the same reason, there are 10 words in the blessing of Hamotzi. Nice, convenient connection. And I'll cut right to the end over here. And there are also 10 words in our verse of the bracha that Yitzchak gave to Yaakov. So the 10 words in this bracha, right, is an allusion to the 10 fingers which have to go on the food, on the bread, when you're making a motzi. So what is that teaching us? What is the message behind that? The idea, I think, is very simple. Because what is eating food? I mean, in terms of physical material activities, which really do distract us easily, is the consumption of food, is eating meals, having food. It's very easy to get distracted. And bread is the symbol of food. It's a symbol, it's a staple of a person's diet. That's one area where it's easy to kind of get distracted and completely lose a sense of godliness and in terms of overeating and all the things we do with food and the forbidden foods. It's endless. So the message is, put your 10 fingers on there and be reminded of this bracha. Put your 10 fingers, be reminded of this bracha that, in my words, I wrote, in eating bread, the symbol of all of our gashmias material activities, infuse it with holiness. In addition to the bracha, Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz, place all 10 fingers upon it and tilt your ear to pay heed to the echo reverberating through the centuries of our forefather Yitzchak, awakening within us the power to transform every mundane act into something meaningful and holy. And that's what we're supposed to do when you make Hamotzi. So this is the bracha. This is what we're supposed to know. Here we are. We are thousands and thousands of years forward from this bracha. We are living here. We are sitting here. And we are being told, you know, Yitzchak told us a long, long time ago, right? Turn everything you do into something meaningful, spiritual. And we should merit to, you know, really have that connection. Hashem should keep giving it to us. Keep giving it to us.